Hello!
And welcome to Dragons Made Me Do It, one of potentially many podcasts about Anne McCaffrey's Dragon Riders of Purin series, but the only one by us.
I'm Tequila Mockingbird.
And I'm Clay.
And today, we are talking about an extremely nothing short story, Ever the Twain. I think its only claim to fame is that it's the last one that McCaffrey wrote independently.
That's not true.
Shut up. I refuse to acknowledge the existence of any other subsequent short stories, and that is me going on the record. It was included in A Gift of Dragons, and I think was the only new story in that collection.
Yes.
To me, it feels very much like she wrote it because she needed a new short story for the collection, rather than because she actually had anything to say.
Yeah, it is hard to see what this story is adding to Purin that we haven't already had, and easy to see what this story is fucking up about Purin that we thought we already understood. As a note, in today's episode, we will be talking about both human incest and the eugenics involved in dragon reproduction and dragon breeding and hatching.
In Ever the Twain, the twins Neru and Nyan are growing up on Ista. Neru is obsessed with dragons and desperate to become a dragon rider, and so when dragon riders show up to their rural fishing community on search, he's overjoyed, only for them to immediately select his twin sister and not him. He's devastated, and Nyan is like, hey, can he just come along? Please, my family would be allowed to come and watch me impress anyway. Can he please, 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 you know. The dragon riders are like, yeah, sure, that's fine. It doesn't hurt. So they are both taken to the weir and given the, at this point, to the reader, very standard, wow, you're a hatching candidate. This is how it's going to work. They meet one obligatory bully character because it wouldn't be Purin if there wasn't bullying going on.
Yes.
A stuck-up young lady who's confident she will impress the one golden egg. Then on the hatching, sure enough, Nyan impresses the queen, and Neru doesn't impress at first. There's one egg left. It hasn't hatched. And Nyan decides, even though she's told that if an egg doesn't hatch by itself, that means basically that the dragon inside is not viable. Instead of accepting that, she and her dragon pull off a little bit of slapstick and bump into the egg, shattering the shell and releasing the bronze dragonette, who does in fact impress her brother. The other way around, right? The dragon doesn't impress, he does.
No, that was one of the things that confused me about this story, is that they do say the dragon impresses and the candidates are impressed.
Hmm.
Dubious.
Well.
It's not the only dubious thing in this story.
Yeah, and that's kind of all that happened?
I mean, that is all that happened. Well, Nyan and Neru have a little conversation because part of what's been going on is they're really anxious about being separated, and they know they're about to be because they've reached the age of apprenticeships, which apparently everyone does.
Dubious thing too.
And they're not going to have the same apprenticeship, probably. Nyan at the end is like, hooray, now we can stay together. And Neru is like, no, they're going to send you to another weir because they don't need another queen at Ista. Now we're irrevocably separated because also now we have our dragons instead of each other.
And there is a little moment when she impresses where she feels psychically her dragon taking primacy over her psychic bond with her twin.
Yes, they do have a psychic bond, or they did have a psychic bond.
In a way that's kind of interesting. And it, to be fair, is implied that Nyan is very psychic.
Yes.
That's part of why she is searched. We do also note, as always, that the bully don't worry, impressed a green dragon. I feel like half of the green dragon riders we know are jerks.
Yeah.
What about all those poor blue dragon riders who have to fall in love with them, whether they want to or not?
It's true.
It's tough out there.
Yeah. Clearly, this is why everyone was so weird about Ty in Skies of Purin. Because they're like, well, she impressed a green, so she must be a jerk.
Right. She must have been a huge bully as a child. That's the only person who impresses a green dragon.
Yeah. God, imagine if Kylara had impressed a green.
I mean, I feel like, though, there was a lot of subtext that implied that she should have, right? Didn't we get somewhere like Kylara, whose appetites were more akin to a green than a gold, or something like that?
Oh, yeah, there is something about that. You're right.
This narrative implication that you're kind of a mean slut, you clearly should have been a green dragon rider.
Yeah, we know from everywhere that the defining characteristic of green riders is slutty, so...
And yet they're the most valuable dragons in Thread.
Yes. So the big question right off the bat with this story is, what century are we in? Hello?
Okay, I read this, and I was like, I guess we're in the really late ninth past, because we've got female green dragons. Dragon Riders again.
A lot of female Green Dragon Riders. So we have to be quite late.
I think both of the Green Dragon Riders who come on search
are women.
Are women. Yeah. And then we have another young woman impressing a Green.
Yes.
And I don't think we get any male Green Dragon Riders name dropped, at least.
I don't think so. We, in fact, have two new female Green Riders because Orla also impresses.
Oh, yes, yes. So I was like, that's a big shift. But you were like, oh, well, this is clearly the second pass.
Yeah, I don't think it can be the ninth pass for a couple of reasons. The biggest of which is, in order for it to be late enough in the ninth pass that there are lots of female Green Riders, and for there not to have been any comment about that, it would have to be like turn 40 of the ninth pass.
Yeah.
In which case, I think we would almost certainly get some comment on the fact that Thread is ending, especially because Neru is so obsessed with Dragon Riders and wants to lead a fighting wing. Thread's going to be done in 5 years, so sorry.
You're going to be an astronomer, kid.
Yeah, so I think it has to be relatively early or in the middle of the pass.
And I think that does make sense when I thought about it.
Which would mean it can't be the ninth pass. So then I was like, okay, we know there are female Green Riders, so it can't be between the sixth and ninth passes, at least.
Yeah.
And presumably it has to be sometime well before the sixth.
Yeah.
So then you suggested maybe the second.
I would say before the fifth pass, because by the time we're in the sixth pass, people aren't even considering it.
Yeah. The wiki also thinks it's the second pass. But for me, if it's the second pass, that means computers are within living memory. And that does not seem to me like it lines up with the level of technology or anything else about the social stuff that we see in this story. So I think it has to be sometime later.
Well, there's also the fact that they refer to the Harper Hall.
Yes, right.
And if it's the second pass, it would have been the college that is transitioning to a musical structure.
Yeah.
And probably not just the Harper Hall.
So if it were the second pass, it would have to be the end of the second pass. And again, computers would still be within living memory.
So I think I'm going to put my money on early third pass.
Maybe, yeah.
Because that gives it 200 years for the Harpers to be established. But the other thing we noticed is there's still maybe some wobbliness about the craft hall systems.
Yeah.
We have artists still, which is something that either hasn't come up at any point in the ninth pass or isn't a thing anymore in the ninth pass.
Right. Specifically, we have artists as something separate from Harpers.
Yeah.
Because we do see an artist in the ninth pass, but he is a journeyman Harper. And that seems to be standard.
And it would make sense to me if that eventually melded together, because you had this idea of people who do artistic stuff. And then you were like, oh, also the college is going to do a bunch of music. And over 1,000 years, I can see how people with artistic talents would end up folded into the Harper Hall.
Yeah.
Instead of remaining distinct.
It might be the kind of thing where, like, oh, you do your art training at an artist's specific facility, but when you achieve rank in the craft, it's as a journeyman Harper for legal purposes, rather than having artist as an independent craft. But also then we were thinking about
the fake good version of Pern that only exists in our heads.
Well, because I was thinking about artists, and I was thinking, well, there are other craft that are explicitly described as having journeymen or masters, but who aren't, among other things, invited to the meeting at Bend and Weir that even the Master Weaver is invited to in Dragonflight. So of all of the craft masters, the Master Vintner is not there, for example. And by the same token, in Dragonsinger, when they're at the Gather, the person they buy the bubbly pies from is described as a journeyman baker, which could mean that he's a journeyman in some random other craft who happens to bake, but really sounds like he is a journeyman and his craft is baking.
It is also possible, I don't insist upon it, that because the craft system is so established, journeyman there is just standing in for a young person who is not yet especially established in their skill.
Hmm.
Right? Mentally might just be assuming that any young person without a master's knot is a journeyman because that's so default to her.
Maybe. But she's from a context where there aren't that many crafters. Like, she grew up in Half Circle.
Yes. Perhaps there's enough specificity around journeyman as a legal term that it wouldn't just be used casually in that way. But that's the only other thing I can think of.
Well, my other suggestion was that there may be decentralized crafts, maybe like the runners. The runners are clearly explicitly described as a craft. Tenna is attempting to be certified as a journeyman, but we don't get any indication that there is a single master runner. It seems like there are a bunch of station masters, and when you are promoting someone, you do it by bringing someone in from another station to validate them against the craft standards, but not like there is a central runner administration. And so it occurred to me that that might also be the case for the vintners and bakers and maybe artists, conceivably, that there are master artists who hold that rank as artists in their own right rather than as harpers, but without there being a centralized artist administration. You just bring in an external examiner from a different hall to validate someone's credentials, or maybe multiple examiners. examiners if they're pursuing mastery rather than journeymanship.
And that's not too different from the way that, for example, early modern Holland handled artistic mastery. You made something that you were like, hey, I think I'm good. And it was usually a Bible scene. And then a credentialed and well-known artist from your community or a nearby community would come and be like, yep, this kid's got it. He's in the guild.
Mm.
And it wasn't like there was one artist of Holland who was in charge of making sure, because that would be ridiculous.
Yeah.
I also personally think that trying to anoint one person as the master artist for all of Perd would be such a shit show that I can understand that they decided not to go with that plan.
The upside is that artist appears to mean exclusively painting and drawing, right? There's no indication that there's sculptors on Pern. There's references to carvings. We know there are stonemasons,
yeah.
But we also know that the stonemasons are not an independent craft. It's just miners who dabble.
Yeah.
Which is unhinged, first of all, but...
And similarly, I feel like any textile arts would be in the Weaver's Guild.
There's not a bust of Master Tyrone at the Harper Hall or anything like that.
No. Which is odd, because especially in a society where you can't write a lot of things down, I would think that sculpture would be great.
Yeah.
Maybe there just isn't good mud for it on Pern.
And among other things, it seems like the kind of thing that would be ideal for ensuring that the charter is remembered.
Yeah.
That's a classic use of sculptures. You put up an obelisk or a stela and you inscribe it with the text of your peace treaty or tribute agreement or whatever else.
And they do have the finger rock and whatever, but they just don't inscribe anything on it.
Yeah.
Which seems like it would have been easy to be like, hey, thread, arrow.
Yeah. Crucially, all of this is entirely our speculation as we attempt to make sense of the timeline in this story. The other problem with the timeline in this story is that we do get one reference to currency, but it's credits. Which is a problem because we know from Dragon's Eye that by the second pass, they're already called marks. I think she'd completely lost the thread of where in the timeline anything was, is kind of what I think about this story.
Yeah, our attempt to make it make sense is that credits is an Istan regionalism.
Yes.
That persists.
Much like husband and wife are a High Reaches regionalism.
Yeah, so when Ivis shows up, the Istans are going to be feeling extremely vindicated.
Yeah.
Because everyone's been making fun of them for 2,000 years.
Baffling. That's really the big thing that there is to talk about this story. Plot-wise, there's not really anything here that we haven't already seen in the many impression scenes and descriptions of impressions that we've had over the course of the series. The one, I guess, not novelty, but thing we haven't had in a while, the first time is since Dragonflight that we've had it from the perspective of a female candidate. So that is mildly novel.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And I could see her going back to her roots.
Yeah. No leg injuries in this one, though.
What does it all mean? And I do think it brings up something that we've discussed most extensively in The Smallest Dragon Boy, which this very much reminds me of The Smallest Dragon Boy.
Yes.
And similarly, sort of feels like she wrote a short story. She didn't really have anything to say. And she was like, yeah, let's have him impress a dragon. That's good. We are presented again with the question of how Calvinist are we? Is impressing a dragon your destiny from the moment you're born? Are there categories of people who are always going to impress, people who are never going to impress, and people for whom it's situational? How much is it about just being the person who happens to be standing there on the sand when the baby dragon shows up? And I don't think this directly contradicts anything we've learned before, but I do think it complicates a few things. Because we had settled, and this is us, we're not in charge, on when the dragon comes out of the egg, they head for the best candidate in proximity, with perhaps an emphasis on people who are young and anticipating impression or dreaming of impression or who want to impress.
Yeah.
Because we have never seen anyone over the age of like 20 impress. Even when people who are not supposed to be hatching candidates suddenly get yoinked onto the sand by a baby dragon, they're usually teens or tweens.
Yeah. The one question mark is Ty, who I think was probably around 20 and may have been a little bit older, but not much older.
Yeah. Often those people who randomly get pulled into impression, Talion, Miriam, Ty, Jaxum, are people who have been around dragons or are interested in dragons or are eager to impress. I don't think we get a lot of unwilling candidates.
except Ty, basically.
Yeah, and we don't see her impression, we just hear about it later.
Yeah.
So there's a lot that we're guessing. And they often go past other candidates who are standing there, right? So it's not a pure proximity thing.
Yeah.
But we do sometimes see sort of broadly unwilling candidates in that the girls who are searched are often very scared or freaking out, fainting or running away or whatever. And usually those girls don't impress.
Yeah.
But I think we've seen it happen once or twice.
The closest in some ways is Nyan in this story.
Yeah. Well, and Jorah.
Yeah, and Jorah. But we don't know what happened to Jorah's impression.
Right. So I think it seems like dragons don't go for someone who's genuinely, really, truly unwilling. But also, as soon as they make that psychic connection with you, how much agency do you have?
Yeah.
/ are you getting brain drenched in psychic love and companionship and affection that's going to make you go like, yeah, this is great, even if you might have, given a more rational decision-making process, decided you didn't want to be a dragon rider.
Yeah.
So this is all the soup that we're swimming in here, where, as they pointed out, Nyan doesn't really want to impress. She is standing there on the hatching ground being like, let my brother impress. And her dragon takes her by surprise.
Literally, her dragon jumps on her back and pushes her to the ground because she's ignoring her dragon.
But then is very like, oh, you don't want me. And immediately, Nyan's like, oh, wait, no, I do want you. Quinth, it's okay. I love you.
Quinth's scene is great.
You don't like me? The dragon asked, her head drooping with disappointment and her wings sagging to the sand. It's not a question of liking you, Quinth, Nyan replied. It's just that I shouldn't impress unless my brother does too. While we wait for that to happen, the little queen said imperiously, you may feed me, Nyan. I'm starving.
I loved that.
She immediately is like, oh, okay, yeah, this is my dragon. And I think we get the implication that Nyan is an incredibly good candidate and incredibly psychic.
As evidenced by her psychic bond with her human brother.
Right. And when they're searching, the dragon riders on search are like, oh, wow, this kid, absolutely. And Oswyth, a green dragon, says, the boy is strong, but his twin shields him from me, Oswyth said to her rider. I cannot see his potential clearly. It is strange. Perhaps he should come along as a candidate too. So I don't think we're supposed to think that Neru isn't capable of being a dragon rider or doesn't have that dragon rider potential. It's just less obvious than Nyan's.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things that they do as part of their 24 hours of hatchling training is help change the bandages on an injured dragon.
Yeah.
And after they have finished doing that, the injured dragon, I believe, tells his rider that both of them will be strong candidates. And to me, it felt like the dragon's being like, ah, now that we can see him clearly, of course he was a good candidate.
There's a degree to which this feels like a clear attempt to introduce a little bit of narrative tension, right? She wanted something a little more emotionally engaging than just they go to the weir, they impress a dragon, the story is over. And so we have this, oh no, will Neru be able to impress or won't he? Kind of tension introduced.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's a bad form of tension because, yeah, if your sibling has something that's been their dream their whole life and suddenly it looks like you might get it and they won't, that would be emotionally complicated, especially when it is a high prestige thing that many people do want.
Yeah.
But I think it's interesting, the idea that the hatchling decides, because I think that's true. But we also have nobody was going to help this little dragon hatch, right? Larynth, all of the people at the weir are like, oh, if they don't hatch on their own, it's not going to happen. So the implication narratively is that if Nyan and Quinth had not interceded, then Larynth would just have died in the shell and Neru would not have impressed and would just have been one of the many people who hypothetically have the capacity to be a good dragon rider, but just don't end up impressing. Like Robinton, like Alessin.
Also, though, we do know from later books that you can stay at the weir and try at least a couple more times or until you're a certain age. It was a little vague depending on the book, but it's not mentioned here.
Yes, although the twins are 16, so...
Yeah, I think we get an age limit, and I think it's later, but I could be making that up.
Okay. And there's also the question of which pass we're in, because I could absolutely believe that early, when you have a glut of candidates, you're like, one or two and done. And if you're running a little low, you might be like, yeah, kids, stay at the weir, see what happens. It also depends how many queens you have producing eggs at any given time. It was interesting to me, this very automatic, like, well, of course you'll leave Ista Weir, because we've seen weirs have multiple queen dragons before.
Yeah, It's not explicit. I assume that the implication is that Ista has a lot of queens.
Yeah.
But there's also, frankly, I was expecting this story to have a much stronger implication of incest than it actually did, based on the summary that I had seen on the wiki. But the specter of incest is looming over us here.
Yeah, because that is hypothetically, right, the other reason that you might separate siblings who have both impressed.
Especially if one has impressed a queen and one has impressed a bronze.
Because you don't want Larynth flying quinth. What we have seen in the past is when one queen goes into a mating flight or seems like she's about to, they clear all of the other queens out of the weir. Hop on your dragon, fly off. That's what we see in Dragon Quest.
It's dealt with explicitly in the Fort of Red Hanrahan, right? Because they
Right.
say that they had a queen die that way.
And so now they know. So presumably, if you're doing that, oh, Quinth is getting proddy, evacuate all the other queens. You could also evacuate Larynth and Nerru and anybody who is too closely related. And presumably, in a situation, especially over the long interval when Benden's down to the only weir and you don't have another weir to send dragon riders to, that's what you would do with children of someone whose dragon is going to mate.
Yeah, if Fallon and Jorah had had a child, presumably that child would have been excluded from Jorah's mating flights.
Right. And I can't help but think that there's a certain utility in the weir naming conventions that way. Because if you're having a bunch of kids with a bunch of different people and you're not raising those kids, so you kind of loosey goosey, it would be convenient to have a very efficient way to be like, okay, this dragon is going up for mating flight. Who should be evacuated?
Yeah, well, and we know from Moretta that that's one of the Weir Woman's jobs, is to track interpersonal relationships and genealogies within the Weir for that reason.
So there's a little bit of the specter of that, but it could also be that maybe Ista has a lot of queen dragons, or that they're expanding another weir, or that another weir is low and there's a need to shuffle things around.
Yeah, there's also, we know Moretta impressed not at Fort
Right.
and was shuffled around to Fort. So there's precedent in other books.
Yeah.
We're explicitly told that incest between dragons is not a problem. Kailara's perspective tells us that, although maybe we should take it with a grain of salt. But it does seem like moving queens around, and here the question of what do you do with unhatched eggs does suggest that dragon riders are to some extent engaged in active husbandry of dragons as a species, that there is an active breeding and eugenics program to ensure that only the best dragons survive and to produce the best dragons. So shuffling queens around makes sense to diversify the gene pool in any given weir. And by the same token, the evidence that we get, namely Ruth and here Larynth, suggests that actually plenty of unhatched dragonets would be fine,
Yeah.
even if they can't break their shells themselves. But the weirs have decided collectively that dragonets that can't break their shells are too weak to live. That's a eugenic program.
Yeah, well, and especially given that dragons hatch fully able to communicate and knowing their name and all of that.
Yeah, presumably they also know their name and all of that while they are trying to get out of the shell. It doesn't come to them fully formed in the instant they break through the shell.
Yeah, so that's a bit rough, but also fully in keeping with what we've seen about eugenics on Pern all along.
Yeah, it makes sense that it extends to dragons, even if it hasn't been the focus of the narrative in any other text, other than with Ruth. But Ruth is a special case because he's a weird dragon to begin with. This suggests that some of the dragon eggs that don't hatch.
Could have just been very quote unquote normal dragons.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think we see this even in Dragonstone, where after Kitty Pengyang dies and her daughter Windblossom is trying to continue the dragon program, what she produces are the Watchwares. And there's this huge animosity, like, oh, they're gross, they're not as good as regular dragons, they're sports, they're freaks. You literally had your first set of normal, quote unquote, dragons 10 minutes ago. What do you mean these are bad dragons? You don't know that yet.
Yeah, maybe they just look ugly when they hatch sometimes.
Yeah, it's okay, guys. And okay, they're photophobic. And?
Don't worry, Thread doesn't fall at night, so.
Well,
Except in the Todd books.
anyway, as I understand it, Todd did engage more with the Watchwares as a concept,
Yes.
but we don't read those, so I'll never know what he decided to do. And the other question, I guess, that I would have about shuffling queens around and breeding programs is maybe this is early enough that it's still an active project to increase the size of the dragons. Because if we're early in the third pass, we're only 700, 800 years into the program. Well, that's a lot of time. So it feels like the dragons should have been full size by then, but I don't actually know. I do think the implication is that they continue to get larger for the entire history of Pern. But I believe what we're told by extra canonical information is that they achieve full quote-unquote size pretty quickly and then just keep growing incrementally after that, because the very first dragons are only a little bit bigger than a horse. And we go from a little bit bigger than a horse to the size of a 747. There's quite a lot of growing to do.
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem implausible to me that at some point over this 2,000 years, right, they decided, oh, if they don't hatch, they're not viable. How would they know, right?
Well, we're explicitly told that they haven't done autopsies.
Because we are told in Dragon's Dawn that they do autopsies on the eggs that don't hatch, and that there are a number of eggs that don't hatch because, again, they're bioengineering these dragons from the ground up. They're very pleased to like, wow, we got 18. That's really good. That's more than we thought we would get out of the total number of eggs, which is greater than 18.
Here's the passage in Dragon's Eye. There were also cases where an egg did not hatch. In the early days when the technology had still been available, necropsies had been performed to establish cause. In most of the recorded instances, there had been obvious yolk problems or the creature had been malformed and would not have survived hatching. Three times, however, the cause of death could not be established, as the fetus had been perfect with no apparent deficiency or disability. The message was handed down to dispose of such unhatched eggs between immediately, a duty performed on such rare occasions by the Weirleader and his bronze. So that suggests that sometimes dragons are fine and they don't hatch for reasons that they don't understand, and they have just given up on those dragons because they've decided that not hatching is in and of itself evidence of a
lack of viability. Yeah. And I think yet again we are being told there's no superstition on Pern, and I'm like, that kind of sounds like a superstition right there.
It does a little bit, yeah.
And I personally believe that humans are just predisposed to superstition. If you don't give us one, we'll make them up. Every community of small children I have known, both as a child and as an adult who works with small children, have come up independently with brand new and exciting superstitions.
Well, something to look forward to when we get to Beyond Between.
No, there isn't, because we won't. You can't make me, no matter what kind of poll results you get.
By way of recommendation to go with this story, it's quite out there. My recommendation is Ursula K. Le Guin's The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas, which is a story about a society that's built on putting all of your expectations and weight and offloading everything onto children, which is not exactly what happens with dragon riders, but maybe there's some resonance there to explore. And in any case, I think it's a better story than this, and a story that often either goes unread or goes badly misread. And it's always worth encouraging people to go back to it and really sit down with the thought experiment that it is posing. Thanks for listening to this episode of Dragons Made Me Do It. If you enjoyed it and want to hear more, you can follow us on Tumblr at dmmdipodcast.tumblr.com for updates, or to send us questions or comments, and you can find our archive of episodes along with transcripts, recommendations, funny memes, and more at dmmdipodcast.neocities.org.